On Sunday, November 16th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents Joseph Daly, low brass specialist on tuba, euphonium, and trombone. Join us as we present the first of a two-part discussion with Joseph Daly. That's Sunday, November 16th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
So sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some syrup in my bowl.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Joseph Daly.
Hi, Joseph Daly. Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
It's a great pleasure, and I'm a great admirer of your programming, and it's a great honor for me to be a participant.
Now, I've seen you described as a low-brass player.
Well, some people, in my description, it says low-brass specialist sometimes. People put that because my main instrument is tuba, and many people are reluctant to put down that pretty much he plays tuba. Besides playing tuba, I play euphonium, and I also play trombone. So what they normally do is just put that into a big category and call that low brass specialist. You know, they kind of touch an inner part of my being. You know, I love those low frequency sounds, and I really enjoy playing those instruments. The size of the tuba is a thing that most people bring to my attention. Why do you play a big instrument? Oh, why don't you switch to piccolo? I said, if I played piccolo, I probably wouldn't be working at all because piccolo doesn't move me, so I wouldn't be practicing it. And the tuba really, the sound of the tuba really moves me and kind of vibrates the spectrums of my soul. And also, All of my close friends play that instrument. All the great mentors that guided my career play that instrument also. Like, you know, for instance, Howard Johnson. Of course, my greatest mentor is Howard Johnson, who has, you know, kind of took me under his wings when I was very young and kind of guided me along and showed me the possibilities of that instrument. The other player, of course, is the great Bob Stewart, who is also a major innovator on the instrument. And these two musicians, in fact, I could just name just about everybody in the tuba ensemble that I joined in the early 70s. Dave Bargeron, Bob Stewart, Howard Johnson, and Earl McIntyre. Jack Jeffers was also in that ensemble. And the lead player at that time was a person called Morris. These are all phenomenal musicians that totally understood the music, understood jazz and jazz improvisation. And they saw exactly how the tuba can fit into it in a very innovative way. And they were called by the greatest musicians of the time, like Charles Mingus and other musicians of that caliber, to perform in their ensembles on tuba. You know, the Charles Mingus, Gil Evans, just to name a few, Taj Mahal. So these great musicians call these major innovators into their groups and ask them to do something with the instrument that's never ever been done before. And I was just very fortunate to be able to tag along and be part of that experience because of a person like Howard Johnson, who was such a major influence. And he would invite me to come down and attend some of the rehearsals, and I would play some of the rehearsals, and the group leaders would hear me, and then they would ask me if I was interested in joining. But I wasn't scared. Like, when I first joined Gil Evans, Howard wasn't scared of having two tuba players in one band, and Gil wasn't scared of it either at that point, too, because he really trusted Howard. Most band leaders, they can't even figure to do with one tuba. Thank you.
unfair. She comes to me with a thousand smiles. She gives to me free. It's alright, she says, it's alright. Take anything you want from me. Free. Mind is running wild. He gives anything I want and I need. Anything free, yeah. She's not giving me anything.
Gil held the possibilities immediately of the two tubas working together in tandem. And also, Hava convinced Taj Mahal not only two tubas, but he was trying to get all six players of the Gravity Ensemble. At that time, it was called Substructure. Hava was trying to get Taj Mahal to take all of them on the road, but because of budgetary reasons and transporting that many musicians across the country. And you got to realize, when you're talking about tubas, you're talking about huge cases and all the technical problems that would happen with that. So Taj says, okay, I can't take six, but I'll take four. So Taj took four of us, and it was myself, Earl McIntyre, Bob Stewart, and Howard Johnson. We became the horn section for Taj Mahal, and that had never been done before.
You're gonna need somebody on your barn, baby. You're gonna need somebody on your barn. It's a late in a midnight, and old man death come slipping in the room. And you gonna need holy time, somebody on your own. Oh, you take Mary and Martha standing up on the hillside. Mary standing to Martha, not a look at the river deep in the water wide. Here come on Moses. Yes, you will.
Honey, yes, you will. Give me some help. Yes, you will. Give me some. Baby, yes, you will. You can do it. You jacked up to it. Oh, baby, when you move, let your body fly. You gonna need, you can't do it. You need somebody on your ball. Give me some help, on. Have a good time, man. Everybody sometimes have the blues. Oh, they gotta sit down and cry. But you know you gonna need somebody. Somebody on your bone.
Howard's whole career, just about everything that he's done on tuba was innovative and probably not ever done before. And then when you see not only his ability to do that for himself, but also to be able to help others do the same by bringing them along, he brought all of us along. And we created this beautiful, wonderful, marvelous sound that has not been duplicated to this day, over 40 years now.
Now, we sort of rushed ahead. I understand that you played in church. I don't know what you played in church, but I understand you played in church and in high school.
I began music in 1959 in New York City public school system. The elementary school I was in, it began a instrumental music program. And my mother, well, she grew up in West Indies, and she really loved music. So as soon as the notice came to my home that they're looking for students to join this new band program, my mother signed me up immediately for that particular program. So I was able to begin learning music in the New York public school system in as early as 1959. And I began on trombone, and then when I went to junior high school, my first year in junior high school, I pretty much stayed on trombone for about 6 months out of the year. And then the band director asked me to switch to tuba. So I switched to tuba in junior high school, and we had a phenomenal band, over about 100 students in the junior high school band. It was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It was called Corleo Junior High School 12, and the band director's name was Mr. Sapoznik. And I still remember him to this day coming to me and saying, because at that time I was playing, I had worked up to become the first trombone player in the band, so I was playing first trombone in the band. And a lot of that had to do with my parents, both my mother and my father. We were very, very poor people. but they found the way of not only finding money to get me an instrument, but she also found a way to get me involved with the Hemisphere Solomon. That's why I began my music lessons. Lessons are like a dollar a lesson, but like they say in the song, you know, it's a dollar a lesson, but you don't have a dollar. You know, so, but she kind of managed, because we were very, very big families. She had quite a few expenses to deal with on a weekly and a monthly basis. She found the necessary funds to make sure that I took theory and harmony lessons and trombone lessons at the Hemisphere Solomon. That in conjunction with my lessons at school, I was able to be one of the premier trombone players in the junior high school band. But I still remember the day the band director came to me and said, you know, you're doing really fine on trombone, but the tuba section, we need to build that up in order for the band to be a little better balanced. So we're short one tuba player, so would you mind switching to tuba? And you got to realize that these band directors, they have tremendous influence on the students, because you come into a band program and you can't even get a sound out of an instrument, and within a few days you get these, they're not marvelous sounds, but you know, you get an instrument to sound like something, and then after a year or so you're playing songs, you're doing well. So a band director really, really have the respect of the students under their tutelage. And so switching to tuba, and I said, not a problem if you wish me, if that's what you think would be better for the band, if I switch to tuba to balance out the whole, you know, sound of the band, I will. So I switched to tuba, and remarkably, I just picked it up very, very quickly. I picked it up so quickly that I was able to join the Manhattan Junior High School Bar-Wide Band immediately. And
wow.
And then later on, when I became a senior in junior high school, I was able to join. At that time, they had the All-City Junior High School Bar-Wide Band and Orchestra. I was also a member of that. So at that particular time, music in the school, especially in New York, was tremendous. Mm-hmm. Just about every school had a band program. So you went from elementary, then you fed into a progressive junior high school program, and then from a progressive junior high school program, you fed into the high school. So by the time you got to high school, you were playing a good 4, 5, 6 years by the time you got into high school. So when I auditioned for Music and Art High School, and I passed the audition, and I got into Music and Art High School, and immediately moved into the top echelon ensembles, because at Musical High School at that particular time, they had 8 orchestras, they had 8 concert bands, they had all kinds of magical choirs, you name it. It was just a phenomenal school to learn. So it was a life-changing experience for me.
Well, I understand that you also eventually started playing Latin music.
Yeah, I also began to play Latin, because I lived on the Lower East Side.
Right.
So how that came about, living on the Lower East Side, I would be bringing my tuba home in a soft case. So many people on the street thought that I was bringing home, it looked like a conga drum, because you know, it was upright valve. So they thought I played congas or something, but they didn't. So one guy approached me and said, listen, I'm starting a band, you know, I lived in the LaGuardia Projects down there on Clinton and Madison Street. So he approached me and said that he was starting a band, and he wanted a conguero. And I said, well, I don't really have a conga in here, I have a tuba. And he said, it's a tuba. He said, I don't think I could use a tuba. But I said, I also play trombone, too. I still kept my... He said, well, okay. He said, maybe I can use a trombone. So he got my number, and then he called me and said, you're going to have a rehearsal. So you got to realize that at that particular time, I was in a very structured program of music education. We would go through scales, exercise, etudes, and the band director would bring out, you know, music every day. We'd learn a different rhythm and apply that rhythm to sight reading. And so everything that I was taught to that point involved looking at a piece of music on a page. So I got to his house for the rehearsal, and I thought, okay, you know, he would just take out trombone music and put it on the stand, and we would just go ahead and play. So we get there, you know, so the whole band is sitting around his record player, and this guy gets out a record and starts, he drops the needle on the record. I want to play this song, and he plays it, and then he just kept playing it over and over again, and everybody just kind of figured out their parts, and after we got that song together, he dropped another. So that was really my first experience in doing that type of thing, actually picking up music, parts of music, and learning parts away from the sheet music, learning it pretty much. But on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, it was all kinds of Spanish social clubs. So we were quite busy. I mean, we can do on the weekends, you know, we can do like two or three gigs just about every night, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday we would do some afternoon things and into the early evening things. So we were quite busy. So doing that circuit with this band, I eventually ran into Manguito Santa Maria. He heard heard me and asked me. Something happened with the person that was playing trombone in his band, and he asked me to join his band. Now, his band was definitely more structured. I mean, he had arrangements. I think Marty Scheller was the arranger for his band at that particular time. He was also involved with the Fania record label, so we were on Fania Records at the same time. Yeah, and he had great personnel, Renee McLean, Jackie McLean's son.
Yes.
And other musicians of that particular caliber. So I just jumped up a whole nother level when I joined. And Manguito got very busy. He had a small hit on Fania Records at that time called Hey Sister. This was 1969. On that record is where I contributed both as a soloist, but that was also my first opportunity to arrange. I got together with Renee. We sat down and we co-wrote and arranged a couple of tunes for this. It was doing very, very well, and we were working quite a bit throughout. There was like this Latin circuit that happened that was amazing, where you would have these Latin bands that would play. There would be almost sometimes nine to ten bands on a program. Mm. And what would happen is that the band number one would start in Brooklyn, and band number 10 would start in the Bronx.
Wow.
And what would happen is that, you know, they would play one set, and then you move further into Brooklyn or closer to Manhattan and play your second set, and then your third set would be in Manhattan, and then for your fourth set in upper Manhattan, and then your fifth set, you'd be up in the Bronx.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the other band would leap over you. So, you know, it was an amazing thing where you would be able to see all these great, great bands if you just stayed in one location. So I heard all the great Latin bands of that particular time.
Some people may recognize the name Santa Maria. That's Mongo Santa Maria's son.
Yes, Mongo's son. And that band was, besides Renee McQueen, was Andy Gonzalez, Jerry Gonzalez. His brother. Alex Blake was in that band also. But then, of course, that particular time you're talking about, we would be on the same bill with people like Tito Puente or Larry Harlow or Johnny Colon, Willie Colon.
Mm-hmm.
You just named the band that was active at the time. We would kind of intersect with it because there was just so much music going on in the Latin field at that particular time, and so many ballrooms and so many hotels, and it was just a wonderful, marvelous experience for me.
Yeah, and I noticed that Jerry Gonzalez is on your latest portraits.
Jerry played in Mongito's band occasionally. Jerry was very busy even at that particular time, so he would be in and out. But we also attended the same high school. He attended Music and Art High School also. Jerry and myself, Andy, we go back all the way back to high school. In fact, Jerry and Andy would always invite people from Music and Art up to their house because their father was a really fine musician too. And he also was one of the first persons that I knew that had a two-track recorder, meaning that you could record something and then record something over. It was a Tamburg two-track reel-to-reel recorder. What Jerry was doing all the way back then in high school, he would bring us to his house and he would kind of put on something by Tito Puente and then move to the section where it was just rhythm, take out the chorus and everything. And then he would overdub on top of that. He would grab something from John Coltrane and put it on top of that, which really became the basis of his band.
The Fort Apache band.
Yeah. So he was hearing that stuff all the way back in high school. He was
hearing
the combination of these complex Latin rhythms and intense jazz improvisation through chord changes of free form right over the top of those rhythms. And he was hearing that all the way back in high school and discussing it and working that out via that two-track tape recorder.
when you transitioned from trombone to tuba, yeah, you picked it up, but was there anything that you could use from having played trombone to carry
your... The trombone and tuba, and going back to low brass, mm-hmm. they're both low brass instruments, mm-hmm. and the trombone and tuba are both in the same clef, they both play in the bass clef.
Okay.
So there was definitely a lot, that I could use. It's just the mechanics of it was different because the tuba used valves and pistons for that. Mm-hmm. And the trombone, at the time, I was playing slide trombone. I eventually transitioned to valve trombone, later on. But besides the transition from going from a slide instrument that slides back and forth to an instrument that used pistons, everything else was fairly easy. The mouthpiece on the tuba, of course, is a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But not, it's not like going from trumpet to tuba.
Mm.
Which some guys have managed to do. I don't know how they do it. but the mouthpiece is a little bigger, but it's not that much different. The only thing about the tuba is that it's just so low. The sound on the instrument is just so low. It takes a while for your ear to develop because it's been proven that many people with a low instrument is playing very low, that most people just hear it as just one tone. They can't really hear the nuances of that instrument going down chromatically and everything. So it takes a while for your ear to develop to be able to hear the lower pitches in the spectrum. Once your ear has developed to the lower sound of the tuba spectrum, then everything else becomes pretty easy to deal with.
From where do your parents hail? Where were they born?
My parents were born in Muncrat, British West Indies. And what happened, my father moved to the United States in 1943 just on his own. He had two children, my older brother and my older sister. That whole migration thing that happened from the West Indies into Americans, where they just came with nothing but the clothes on their back and everything. So my father was one of those, even though he had to have a sponsor. So he had a sponsor, one relative that had gotten over before him. And sponsorship means that you have to have a place to stay and a good possibility of finding some type of work. So he came over and kind of built a way to eventually have my mother come over in 1948. 5 years later. And then in 1949, I was born, and then my other brother was born a year after in 1950. And then at that point, he was able to get enough money together to bring my older brother and my older sister over. And you can imagine me and my younger brother, we pretty much had the whole house to ourselves. And then all of a sudden, these two people walk in that we've never met. And not only do they walk in, and they're going to live here. Okay, they're going to live here. But then they also tell us what to do.
Right, they're older.
all of a sudden we have an older brother and sister. It was like, oh my God. but it was... I guess that's the way things were kind of done at that particular time.
Sure.
It was an amazing opportunity for him to be able to do this type of thing. But you can imagine, I always think of myself after I had two children, if I had to just get up and just move everything I had into a whole new country, whole new environment, and start from pretty much nothing and build the life for myself and then be able to raise enough money to bring my wife and then eventually my children and start a whole new family in a whole different country, in a whole different location. And I just developed a deep respect for what he was able to do.
Sure, of course.
It was a pretty amazing thing. And because of what he was able to do and accomplish, it kind of reflects on who I am and the kind of opportunities that I was able to get because of where I live and the environment that I was brought up in.
Thank you.
you wind up being involved in the New York and New Jersey public school system for about 30 years?
So after graduating from Music Mountain High School, I was very fortunate to get a scholarship to Manhattan School of Music and study. I began my undergraduate as a performance major on tuba. When I decided to pursue my master's, I was advised by many at that particular time, because of the nature of the music business, that it may be best to get a background in education. So Manhattan School of Music had a graduate program where, as an undergraduate, you can be a performance major, but when you came into graduate school, all your credits can be moved towards developing your degree in music education. And they had a program in conjunction with the New York public school system where performers would come into this program, and then they would be sent out during the day to teach in the public schools and come back and take courses in the evening, and you would work towards a master's degree in music education. But you'd also, at the end of that time, you would also get your license, because you were teaching for a full year, and that would work towards getting qualifications for your license. But you would get your master's degree and you'd get your license. So I was assigned to Wadley Junior High School, PS 88. Principal was, her name was Elfrida Wright. She was a very, very powerful principal. She had that school totally under control. I mean, the students would come into the assembly program, they would have to wear a white top and a black bottom. And she would bring in some tremendous performers to perform in front of the students.
Wow.
Tremendous guest speakers and everything. And she was also one of the assistant conductors of the Manhattan Worldwide Choir. So she was just a very, very powerful person in that whole music spectrum and everything. And she was also so strong that she was able to get high-profile candidates from one of the top conservatories in the country, Manhattan School of Music, to come in and work at her school, because that's how I got in there. And I worked there for 2 years. And then she was also able to get me to become one of the associate conductors of the Manhattan Borough-wide Band. She recommended that they take a look at me, so I went down, conducted a Borough-wide Band, told me to stand in front of the band and go through a couple of numbers with them, and let's see what your technique is. So I went in front of the Borough-wide Band. I went through a couple of numbers with him, and he says, okay, you're hired.
Wow. So, how did you feel doing that? What was the experience like for you?
Well, when I applied for my scholarship to Manhattan School of Music, one of the things I had put down was that, number one, that I would love to become a performing artist. My main reason for going to Manhattan to develop my skills as a performing artist. But if I did not do that, things kind of worked out differently. I wanted to be able to give back all the opportunities that I was afforded. And, you know, those opportunities of learning how to play instrument from junior high school into the Broadway band, into music art high school and full scholarship into Manhattan School of Music. So I wanted to be able to give that back. So that's always been my thing, to give back as much as I've received. So being a former member of the Manhattan Broadway band, it was a type of thing that I just saw it as my opportunity to give back what I've received from that great institution. And I was prepared, you know. When you go to these conservatories, they do prepare you. They, you know, you take conducting classes, you take all kinds of things. In music education course, you learn how to play every instrument. You go through every single instrument. You learn the fingerings, you learn everything. You learn how to play every instrument so that when you're standing in front of a band class or orchestral class, you're not fumbling around. You know exactly how the instrument is set up, how the instrument is put together, how the fingerings, the whole key system, how the embouchure is set up, you know, how to articulate on the instrument, the breathing problems, and other type of thing. So that whole experience was a wonderful thing to me, and I just cherished the fact, and I was really happy that she had that much confidence in me to recommend, because her recommendations are hard to get, and when she recommends somebody to something, people really listen. And the fact that they embraced me when I came in, it was a wonderful thing, and I saw it as a great opportunity to give back. And I embraced it and gave back and worked with those kids as hard as I possibly could to make sure that they reached their full potential.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 16th. In this segment, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's guest is low brass specialist on tuba and trombone, Joe Daly. You can catch him with Hazmat Modine at Terra Blues in the Village on November 22nd. Until then, here's what other Sugar guests are doing in the area. Smoke Jazz is packed with Sugar guests this week. Percussionist Steve Kroon starts things off, leading a sextet on November 19th. Pianist Harold Mayburn and bassist Bob Cranshaw join guitarist John Weber's quartet on the 20th. And trombonist Steve Turay wraps up the week with Vincent Herring's quintet on the 21st to the 23rd. go to smokejazz.com for info on all these shows. That's smokejazz.com. Guitarist Pat Metheny returns to the area with his Unity Group. They'll be at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York on the 19th, Bergen, New Jersey's Performing Arts Center on the 20th, and The Space in Westbury, Long Island on the 21st. Links to all shows are at patmetheny.com. That's patmetheny.com. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria is one of many guests at Jazzmobile's rescheduled 50th anniversary concert on the 21st, hosted by WBGO Radio's Rhonda Hamilton. It'll be at Harlem's First Corinthian Baptist Church. Details are at jazzmobile.org. That's jazzmobile.org. Vocalist Renee Marie will be at 54 Below on the 21st to the 22nd. Details are at 54below.com. That's 54below.com. Bassist Christian McBride is at Newark's NJ Pack on the 22nd with Bela Fleck and the group Brooklyn Rider. See njpack.org for events. That's njpac.org. Blues singer Alexis P. Suter will be at the Records Collector in Bordentown, New Jersey on the 22nd. Info is online at the-record-collector.com. That's the-record-collector.com. Pianist Harold Mayburn returns to Smoke with the Steve Davis Sextet from the 28th to 30th. Go to smokejazz.com for details on that show. Finally, drummer Will Calhoun will be at Irving Plaza with Living Color on the 28th. See IrvingPlaza.com for info on this show. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings and links at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. And a big thanks to everyone who supported us during WBAI's Fall Fun Drive. If you missed it and still want to contribute, click the Support WBAI link at sugarinmybowl.org. This is Hank Williams signing off. With the new biweekly schedule, we're off the WBAI airwaves next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, November 30th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on The Bandstand.
Thank you, Associate Producer Hank Williams. That's right, we will be back on the 28th, right after we've stuffed ourselves with vegetarian food, no doubt. This is WBAI New York. Stay tuned for more Joe Daly and Sugar in My Bowl and the rest of Miles Davis's Amantla, which features former Sugar guest Kenny Garrett. Stay tuned.
When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Well, I guess you weren't at Wadley for all of your career from 1976 to your retirement.
The thing is, I stayed 2 to 3 years, and then what happened, we decided, we were living in Harlem, about 168th Street there, and we decided that we wanted to move to New Jersey because we went to visit one of my friends that lived in Teaneck. At that time, I had a little beat-up car and everything. So he says, you know, why don't you come by my house in Teaneck and see how he's living and everything. So he said, I'm paying about the same amount of money that you're paying for rent and everything, except now I have a house and I'm building up equity. So the whole thing is that, to me, like, New Jersey, even though, you know, I traveled, I went into Newark with some of these Latin bands, but for some strange reason, I had no idea where Teaneck was. So me and my wife, we packed this big picnic lunch and everything, so we thought we'd be traveling by hours and hours, you know, to get to Teaneck, you know. So we were getting ready. So as soon as we crossed the bridge, the next thing we knew, we were right in Teaneck. We were like, oh, man, we didn't even have time to eat one sandwich. So I went and visited him. We saw Teaneck as a really, really fine town. It had a good, solid school system, and, yeah, very close to New York, so I could continue playing gigs and stuff in New York. So we just went and found a realtor, and the realtor found us a beautiful house. And then we were able to save enough. My wife just put away what she had, and we just lived off my salary. And we were able to put down enough to get a down payment on the house. Then we moved into Teaneck. So when I moved into Teaneck, I was still teaching at Wabi and commuting back and forth and everything. Then the musician John Purcell, saxophonist, we were good friends. So he was teaching in Englewood, New Jersey, a high school called Dwight Morrow High School. And his middle school theater program band director was getting ready to leave. And he asked me if I would be interested in possibly taking that position. So I said I would come in and talk. So I came in and talked to the principal, and he came and the principal looked at my resume and says, you know, really, you're kind of overqualified for this job. So I said, I know, but the thing is, you know, I'm only 15 minutes away, and John Purcell is my friend, and, you know, he says, I'll be able to feed musicians to him of the caliber that he needed. So I came in, and I got that position in Englewood, so I left Wadley Junior High School, and I stayed there for the rest of my career. I had a brief hiatus when Sam Rivers asked me to go on the road with him, become a member of his small ensemble with what he called the Tuba Trio. So I left Englewood Junior High School at that time and went with Sam for about 2 years. Towards the end of that period of time, I got a call from Englewood again saying that John Purcell was leaving and they found a new band director for the high school, but he's not working out. Mm. Would I be interested in taking a look at becoming the high school band director?
Wow.
At and they said the reason is because most of the kids who trained in junior high school are now juniors and seniors. They're pretty much the students that you developed and everything. and they're very, very disappointed with what's going on. That's one thing about, like I said, when you come up through a structured program, then when you do a program, you structure it the same type of way.
Right.
I had a structured format that I used, and always my class was always very, very structured and very organized. So the students came in and they saw that this other person was not as structured for whatever reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Then they began to rebel, and then, you know, it became a real battle then.
And it was like, so come get your students.
Yeah, so pretty much that's what it was. So I came back in and I became the high school band director.
Excellent.
The responsibilities of marching band, jazz ensemble,
wow.
You know, theory, harmony, advanced placement, theory, advanced placement, harmony. All those courses I began to teach, I came back in. And I just stayed there for the rest of my career and retired from Dwight Morrow High School.
In 2005?
In 2005, yeah.
Now, Wanda's your wife, right?
Yes, most definitely. Yeah.
Yes. And Wanda, is she a teacher as well?
Well, we met in high school. We went to the same high school. She went to Music and Art High School also.
Oh, okay.
And then she also went to Manhattan School of Music. So in Manhattan, we became close. And then by the time we both moved into the music education program on the graduate level, and that's about that time we decided both, you know, to get married. So we got married then, and then she began teaching also. So she was a vocal major. She was a voice major in Manhattan School of Music, and she also sang in Music and Art. She was also part of the high school, the New York City High School Choir, you know, under Wilhowski, and then on the junior high school level under Motley. These are names that people that grow up in New York in the music education know these names. So she was under those two people while she was in the New York public schools, and then she went to Manhattan School of Music also. And then she became a teacher. But then after we began to have children and she took some time off, she decided that she didn't want to come back into education. So her mother and father were both postal workers. So she took the postal exam.
Okay.
And that's another thing about African-American progress
yes.
and people ascending to the ranks of the middle class. There's more people that have done that through the post office than probably than any other institution in
America. That is so true.
America. So
it was always said that if you want a good job, join the post office.
So I think her mother was working for like pittance. And somebody said, why don't you go take the postal exam? So her mother took the postal exam. And then when she saw the per hour rate, and then she was also able to get a pension, and she was also able to get health care, and then she was also able to get what they call an annuity, which was involved with government bonds, where if you put in half of the money for the government bond, the postal one would match it somehow, and then you would get a government bond, and then that would mature. So it was a good opportunity if you manage the funds well. It really moved her mother and her father right into the middle class. So Wanda's mother suggested that since she really wanted to go back to education, why don't you take the postal exam and come into the post office? And so she did that, and it worked out well, because when you first come in, they put you on the midnight shift, which was good for her. She'll be home during the day while I'm teaching. And then I'll come home, and then she'll go to work, and then she'll do the midnight shift. So we would both be home, you know, for the children until they got to an age where they could manage on their own.
Now, I brought her up because of your latest release.
Right.
Portraits, the complete title. Portraits, Wind, Thunder, and Love. You dedicate a song to Wanda.
song, I wrote this for her many, many years ago and named it after her middle name, which is Doretha. Yeah, because she's just been like a big support to everything that I wanted to do. And we kind of worked together. The whole thing about being married as long as we did, like I think it's 43 years yay, of marriage, everything, is that we both, it's almost like my parents. We both started with kind of nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and we just kind of, you know, we just built, you know, from nothing, and we just kind of, you know, supported each other. And so this particular piece that I wrote for her, it was a dedication that I did many years ago, and I just wanted to bring this out because most of my first three albums are pretty much just documentations of works that I've done over the years. So this is one of the documents that I wanted to be published. But I plan to do a more extensive family suite, which will have a more extensive working of a piece for her.
Okay.
You know, that'll be coming in the future. But for now, though, I thought this would be fine just to introduce her to the people that know me but do not know her.
Well, that's actually my favorite piece on the recording, just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry Gonzalez is on that one.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, Charles is amazing. Anaje plays wonderfully.
Yes.
Jerry's playing some really interesting congas on that one. That's also the piece with the French horn in there. I know on the liner notes it says French horn on track 8, but the French horn is really on track 7. It was just like a typo.
Okay, so, good to know.
But if you listen really carefully under the cellos there, and the cellos are, you know, led by, you know, the phenomenal Akua Dixon, which
yes.
I know you know her. She's amazing. So she's leading that cello section. The French horn is just kind of just hung just right under her.
Akua Dixon also solos on your tribute to Bill Cole.
I've known her for a while. She attended Manhattan School of Music also, and she her and her sister. We played in at that time they had what they called the Harlem Philharmonic.
Oh, okay.
We were members of the Harlem Philharmonic Orchestra in New York City, and we stayed in touch, you know, over the years. And then opportunity for this string project, I just had to make sure that she was aboard. And Charles attended to Music and Art High School also. Charles Burnham, amazing violinist. He's featured on that track, but he's also featured on the Virtues album. If you listen to the track on Dedication to Billy Bang,
yes.
He's also the violin feature on that one.
phenomenal violinist and a phenomenal friend and everything. And that's one thing about growing up in New York and being around all these musicians at a very, very early age. You kind of develop these friendships that kind of last a generation, like a nausea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been friends for such a long, long, long time. I just can't remember ever not knowing him,
you know,
Jerry. And we're just part of this support system. We support each other on each other's projects. Every opportunity to get a chance to go out and hear what each other is doing, we do that. And it's just wonderful.
The composer and conductor, that's you,
yes.
But the concertmaster, Curtis Stewart, is that...
Yes, Bob Stewart's son.
Bob Stewart's son, yes.
Yeah, I called Bob prior to doing this project, because I went and saw Bob with his ensemble, and Curtis was playing violin, and he was phenomenal. Like, the woodwinds and brass players, the percussion players in New York, you know, I have a good understanding of who they are and very, very close friendships with most of them. But, you know, string players were like, you know, this, even though I played in the orchestra, the string section was so far away from the brass section that the interaction between string players and myself were not as close as fellow brass players, woodwind players, or percussion players. So, I knew some string players, like Akua Dixon, I knew them, but the thing is, I wanted somebody that could kind of talk to them and string language.
Right.
You know, so I called Bob and asked him if he think Curtis would be ready to, because being the concert master means that everyone follows his lead, you know, as far as bowing, you know, articulation, everything. The concert master is like the most important member of a string ensemble. He's like the master musician that everyone follows. In other words, he just reports directly to the conductor. And the conductor sometimes, as conductor, you cannot go around and work with all the musicians. Like, you need somebody that knows. So I'm working directly with him, and he's passing the information on, you know, transmitting it from my language into things that string players can understand, like down bow, up bow, you know, giving them the instructions. So he took on this task of being the concert master, contract for the string section. Also, you know, first violinist and the main soloist on most of material with as a soloist, except in times when I wanted to, you know, give other people opportunities to participate in the project also. So he did a phenomenal job. In fact, he just finished Madison Square Garden with Stevie Wonder. He was in a string section with that particular thing. So like, this guy, he's going to have a phenomenal career.
Yeah, wow.
He's very, very gifted.
Now, how did you decide that you were going to have a string voice?
Well, the thing is, I did Seven Deadly Sins, which is a brass percussion and woodwind. With me, many people know me as, you know, a sideman, low brass specialist, or some, you know, a lot of people just, like, some people just know me as an educator. They know me as Mr. Bailey, the music teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Some people know me as the tuba player guy, or the guy to play Mongito, the guy to play for Sam Rivers, and all that. So the whole concept of me as a composer, my ability to orchestrate, write, and arrange, even though I've been doing this since the early 70s, that part of me, many, many people that are in the music business were not aware that I can do that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the Seven Deadly Sins, and that received critical acclaim. It did very, very well and received many Best of CD of the Year awards for that particular year that it was out.
And that was 2011.
Yep. And then at that point, I had to make a decision. Am I going to do another big group thing like that, or am I going to show people another facet of what I do? So I decided to do the latter. Because what happened with that CD, people said, okay, well, he's a brass player, and he knows all these saxophone players, woodwind players and everything. So, you know, people began to, like, say, well, even though they were very surprised that I did it, and they were very surprised at the quality and the level of the writing and the production and the orchestration and everything, they began to, you know, people began to say, well, you know, that's to be expected because of...
Because he's in that section.
So I just went to the entire spectrum. And also, the subject matter for the Seven Deadly Sins, I thought, you know, a heavy orchestration with woodwind and brass would be fine for that. But then I went to the virtues, the seven heavenly virtues. And I said, you know, a whole different color palette would be fine for that, too. So I said, I would like to use a different color palette just to have a lighter texture and everything. So I think strings would be perfect for the virtues, and it would contrast the seven deadly sins, would show people, you know, the full spectrum of my abilities to both work in, you know, string environment and the brass and woodwind environment and everything.
One other person whom you give tribute is Warren Smith, the percussionist, master percussionist.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Warren, as I was mentioning, one of my premier mentors, if not the main major mentor in my life, was, you know, of course, Howard Johnson and everything. But Warren Smith is very close by. The thing is this. Like I said, I've been writing since 1973. Mm-hmm. In fact, that piece, the Aretha and the Blues, was originally written for a brass ensemble that I had back in 1971, 72.
Okay.
Around that place. And we would rehearse at Manhattan School, because I was a student at Manhattan School of Music. We would rehearse at Manhattan School of Music, and I was able to get a couple of performances together. So I was looking for a person to play, you know, percussion. And people say, why don't you call Warren Smith? Now, you got to realize that I'm a college student, and Warren Smith is, you know, he's playing, like, on Broadway with Leonard Bernstein doing West Side Story.
Right,
and
right. He's in the pit.
So you can imagine this guy, he's on, you know, he's doing, like, all the Atlantic sessions for Aretha Franklin.
Right.
And, you know, this guy is, he's, like, one of the premier musicians in New York at that time, and still, in my mind, still is one of the premier musicians in New York. So I called him and said, okay, you know, people said, if you call that I'm looking for a percussion guy to play vibes and marimba and timpani and different things, and would you be interested? And he said, sure. He said, I'll be down. What time do you want me to rehearse? And he just showed up at rehearsal, you know, melted right in and played and worked. And then I was able to get a concert at Carnegie Recital Hall for the Northside Center, which was, you know, on 110th Street, Northside Child Development Center.
Mm-hmm.
They did a fundraiser. So they had a fundraiser at Carnegie Recital Hall. So I was able to bring that brass ensemble to Carnegie Recital Hall. But Carnegie Recital Hall said they're not going to provide any percussion instruments like vibraphones and marimbas and timpanis. You have to bring your own, equipment into that. So I told Warren, you would have to kind of bring. So he said, not a problem. I got all that stuff. I'll bring it. So he brought all that stuff, set it up, and played, and did his thing, and then quietly just took the stuff down and went, you know, went about his business. I was just involved. I was just involved as a conductor, arranging stuff. I had my hands full. I wasn't even thinking. You know, once he would handle it, I wouldn't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But years later, we kept up our relationship. In fact, Warren was part of the tuba trio with Sam, with myself, Warren.
Oh, okay.
So he was part of that famous album, the tuba trio, which was done in the Bim House in Amsterdam.
Oh, okay.
So we continued to work together, and Warren had, of course, the studio Wiz, which was on 21st Street, where it was similar to Studio Risby, where it was a loft, you know, loft jazz scene, a place where you would have musicians come in and work. And those are places that I first met Julius Watkins, Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, through that network that Warren had. We did another performance somewhere, and Warren said, listen, Joe, you know, I'm going to need some help with these timpanis today. You know, so I said, okay, you know, I'll ride back to you to the studio. So we get to the studio, and then he takes out the timpani, and he's... And then I realized, wait a minute, his loft is all the way on the second floor, and there's no elevator, so he has to carry timpani all the way up the stairs, all the way to the second floor.
Wow.
And then I was behind him carrying his timpani. And then I said, you know, and then at that point it hit me, you know, hit me like, oh, my God.
Mm.
You know, he's been, you know, all the time I said I need timpani vibes and all that stuff. Mm. And, you know, he just says, you know, he provide all that stuff, you know. My little mind wasn't even thinking about how is he going to get this stuff back up into his loft and everything.
Right.
So at that point, then I realized, you know, what amazing, not only amazing musician, but what an amazing man he was to be able to give this much to help, you know, somebody which is somebody who's nobody, pretty much somebody, you know, some little college kid that, you know, that he doesn't know from Adam, you know.
Right.
So that hit me. So a few years later, he was doing a performance in Chicago, and they asked him to do a concerto-type piece and everything. And the conductor, Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, said, you know, we want to feature Warren. Warren, do you have a piece that you want to be featured in? And for some strange reason, Warren is a very, very fine composer himself.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent composer. So for some strange reason, he called me up and asked me to write him a piece, for, you know, a suite of pieces for percussionists.
No.
You know, so I'm saying, you know, and not only that, but, you know, he explained to me that it would be conducted by, you know, one of the great black composers, Corbis Taylor Perkinson. So I said, oh, I to this day, I haven't really sat down and even asked him, you know, why he called me. But he called me, something, I guess he heard something I did, and it kind of triggered something in him. So I wrote this piece, this percussion suite for him, which features him on all of these instruments that he has mastered, the vibraphone, the marimba, mm-hmm. the timpani, the gongs, and then finally the drum set. So mm-hmm. I wrote that for him, and they performed it in Chicago. And then when I began to put together the concept for this Virtues album with the string section and everything, I said, I have this string piece. I think it'd be a good opportunity for me to record it at the same time. And I originally wanted to put both albums out at the same time as a double album set, but then I said that might be a little bit too much for me. Everything that I'm doing, you know, I'm paying for myself, you know, I'm budgeting, you know, over the years, you know, through teaching and everything, I was able to save money and a lot of my pension money and all that stuff that
sure.
I'm living on right now
mm-hmm.
is going into, you know, all these projects that I'm doing. So doing the double album set, I said would be too much. So what I did was I just released the Virtues first. And then the piece with Warren with the five movements that I wrote for him with percussion, I released that as a separate CD, and then included the Bill Cole tribute.
listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl's the name of this program that you've been listening to. My name's Joyce Jones. You'll have to excuse me for not being able to read back everything, but we will have a playlist up. We will be back on the 28th, right after everyone has stuffed their faces. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Come back for part two.
Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.